Blue Ocean Strategy by W. Chan Kim and Renee Mauborne. An audio summary narrated for the AIIO Book Library. This book was first published by Harvard Business Review Press in 2005 and expanded in 2015 with three new chapters. It has sold more than 4 million copies and been translated into over 40 languages. It is one of the most widely taught strategy books in the world and one of the most widely misunderstood. The authors are both professors at INSEAD. Their argument grew out of more than 15 years of research covering roughly 150 strategic moves, spanning 30 industries, across more than 100 years of business history. Here is the picture the book asks you to hold in your head. Imagine the whole market universe as two kinds of ocean. Red oceans are the industries that exist today. The boundaries are defined, the rules of competition are known, and everybody is fighting for a share of demand that is already there. As the water gets crowded, margins get thin, products start to look alike, and the water turns red. Blue oceans are the industries that do not exist yet. Demand is created rather than fought over, growth is fast and profitable, and for a meaningful period there is no relevant competition, because you set the rules. The point of the book is not that competition is bad. The point is that competing is a choice, and most companies make it by default. The engine of the whole book is a concept the authors call value innovation. Conventional strategy says you have to choose. You can offer more value to buyers at a higher cost, or you can offer decent value at a lower cost. Differentiate or be the low-cost player, but do not try both, because trying both leaves you stuck in the middle with no real advantage. Value innovation rejects that trade-off. It says the companies that create blue oceans pursue differentiation and low cost at the same time, and they do it by rebuilding the offering rather than tuning it. The mechanism is simple to state and hard to do. You raise buyer value by creating and lifting factors the industry has never offered. You cut cost by eliminating and reducing factors the industry has long competed on, factors that customers were never really paying for. The cost-saving funds, the value creation. Over time, volume drives cost down further, and imitation gets harder. Notice that the word innovation is not doing the work people assume. Value innovation is not technology innovation. A breakthrough with no buyer utility, no accessible price, and no viable cost structure is an invention, not a strategy. Value innovation only happens when innovation lines up with utility, price and cost all at once. The authors also make a claim about what the right unit of analysis is. Not the company and not the industry, because no company is excellent forever and no industry is permanently attractive. The right unit is the strategic move, the set of decisions involved in creating a major new market offering. Study moves, not heroes. They back this with a study of 108 business launches. 86% were line extensions, incremental improvements inside existing red oceans. Those produced 62% of revenues, but only 39% of profits. The remaining 14% were blue ocean creations. They produced 38% of revenues and 61% of profits. Fewer swings, far more of the return. Now to the tools, which are the reason this book keeps getting used long after most strategy books get shelved. The first is the strategy canvas. It is a single picture that does two jobs. It captures the current state of play in a known market space, and it points to where a new offering could go. You draw it as a simple line chart. Along the horizontal axis, you list the factors the industry currently competes on and invests in. Along the vertical axis, you plot the offering level a buyer receives on each factor, low to high. Plot your own line and your rival's lines, and you get what the authors call value curves. The revealing thing about a strategy canvas is how often every player's curve has the same shape. Same peaks, same troughs, different logo. That is a picture of a red ocean, and it is also a picture of an industry that has stopped asking questions. A good blue ocean value curve has three qualities you can check by eye. Focus, meaning the curve is not high on everything it commits. Divergence, meaning the shape genuinely differs from the industry curve, rather than tracking it slightly above or below. And a compelling tagline, meaning the strategy can be stated in one true sentence that also works as a promise to the customer. Southwest Airlines, in the book's telling, offers the speed of a plane at the price of a car, with the flexibility of frequent departures. If you cannot write that sentence, you probably do not have a strategy yet. You have a budget. The second tool turns the canvas from a diagnosis into a design. It is the four actions framework, and it asks four questions about your industry's accepted factors. Which factors that the industry takes for granted should be eliminated entirely? Which factors should be reduced well below the industry standard? Which factors should be raised well above the industry standard? And which factors should be created that the industry has never offered? The first two questions attack cost. The second two attack value. Asking all four together is what breaks the trade-off. Most companies only ever ask the raise and create questions, which is exactly why their cost base grows every year. The authors express the answers in a grid with four boxes, called the Eliminate, Reduce, Raise, and Create grid. It is deceptively powerful because it is easy for anyone in the business to fill in. It forces you to act on all four questions rather than the comfortable two, and a grid full of vague words exposes a strategy that is not real. Cirque du Soleil is the standing example. It eliminated animal acts, star performers, aisle concessions, and the three-ring format. It reduced fun and humor and thrill and danger. It raised the uniqueness of the venue. And it created a story theme, an artistic score and dance, multiple productions and a refined watching environment. Animals are expensive to buy, house, transport, care for and insure. Removing them cut an enormous cost while removing something the modern audience had grown uneasy about anyway. The saving paid for theatrical production values that let Cirque charge theatre prices rather than circus prices. Casella Wines did the same thing to wine with the brand Yellow Tail. It eliminated wine jargon, aging qualities, and above-the-line marketing. It reduced the complexity of the wine, the size of the range, and the prestige of the vineyard. It raised retail store involvement. It created easy drinking, ease of selection, and fun and adventure. It sold to people who found wine intimidating and became the fastest-growing brand in the history of both the Australian and the United States wine industries. Part 2 of the book turns to formulation, and it opens with the question people always ask: where do blue oceans actually come from? The answer is the Six Paths framework. Each path is a boundary that most industries treat as fixed, and each one can be looked across. Path 1, look across alternative industries. Not substitutes, alternatives. Different form, different function, same objective. NetJets looked at the gap between commercial first class and owning a private jet, and sold fractional ownership of an aircraft. Path 2, look across strategic groups within your industry. Most industries sort themselves into tiers, ranked by price and performance, and everyone competes inside their own tier. Curves built a women's fitness business in the gap between the full-service health club and the home exercise video. Taking the convenience and low cost of one and the equipment and social commitment of the other. Path 3, look across the chain of buyers. There is usually a purchaser, a user, and an influencer, and industries develop a habit of serving just one of them. Novo Nordisk shifted attention from the doctors who prescribe insulin to the patients who administer it and produce the insulin pen. Bloomberg shifted from the technology managers who bought terminals to the traders and analysts who actually used them and designed for the user instead. Path 4, look across complementary products and services. Ask what happens before, during, and after your product is used. Barnes & Noble treated the bookstore as a place to read rather than a place to buy. Philips looked at what British tea drinkers actually hate, which is limescale, and built the filter into the kettle spout. Path 5, look across functional and emotional appeal. Industries drift toward one pole and then compete there forever, usually accumulating features or rituals nobody asked for. Swatch pushed a functional commodity watch into emotional territory. The Body Shop went the other way, stripping the glamour out of cosmetics. QB House stripped the Japanese barbershop back to 10 minutes and a flat 1,000 yen by removing the tea, the hot towel, and the shoulder massage. Path 6, look across time, not forecasting but participating in the shaping of a trend that is already visible. The authors set three tests: the trend must be decisive to your business, it must be irreversible, and it must have a clear trajectory. Apple watched illegal file sharing and concluded that people wanted single tracks rather than albums and would pay for a legal, high-quality, well-organized version of the same thing. Chapter 4 is about the planning process itself, and it is the chapter most readers skip and later wish they had not. The argument is that conventional strategic planning produces a thick document full of numbers that describes the current industry in the current industry's language, and that this process almost guarantees a red ocean outcome. The remedy is to make drawing the strategy canvas the planning process, not a slide inside it. The authors set out 4 steps. Visual awakening, where you draw your as-is curve alongside your competitors and confront how similar they are. Visual exploration, where you leave the building, walk the 6 paths, and observe how people actually use alternatives, including what makes them stop. Visual strategy fair, where you present competing to be canvases to real customers, to your competitors' customers and to non-customers, and let them choose. And visual communication, where the chosen strategy is distributed as one picture that any employee can read, so that projects which do not fit it become obvious. The chapter closes with a portfolio tool called the Pioneer Migrator Settler Map. Settlers are me-too businesses with value curves that match the industry. Migrators offer more than the industry, but are not fundamentally different. Pioneers are the value innovators, the businesses with a real blue ocean curve. Plot today's portfolio and tomorrow's pipeline, and if both are crowded with settlers, you can see your future growth problem years before it appears in the accounts. Chapter 5 attacks 2 habits that feel like best practice and quietly keep you in the red ocean. The first is focusing on existing customers. The second is ever finer segmentation to serve them better. Both push you toward customization and away from scale. Blue oceans need the opposite move. You desegment. You look for the powerful commonalities in what people value, and you aggregate demand rather than slicing it. To find that demand, the authors point at non-customers and identify 3 tiers by how far away they sit. The first tier are the soon-to-be non-customers. They sit at the edge of your market and buy the minimum out of necessity rather than preference, and they will leave the moment something better appears. Pret-a-manger, built on office workers who were buying restaurant lunches without enjoying them, and wanted fresh food, fast, without the wait. The second tier are the refusing non-customers. They have looked at your industry and consciously chosen against it, on price, on complexity, or because it makes them feel foolish. Callaway looked at people who did not play golf and found that many of them simply could not reliably hit the ball, so it built a club with an oversized head. The third tier are the unexplored non-customers. They are in markets nobody in your industry has ever considered theirs, and they are usually the largest group of all. J.C. Deco looked at outdoor advertising, saw that its weakness was transience, and offered municipalities free street furniture, bus shelters, and public amenities in exchange for exclusive advertising rights on them. That created a permanent city center advertising medium out of a market nobody had counted. The instruction is not to pick one tier. It is to go for the biggest catchment and to check the commonalities across all 3 before choosing. Chapter 6 is where a good idea gets stress tested, and it is the most commercially useful chapter in the book. The sequence runs in one direction, and every step is a pass or fail gate. Buyer utility comes first. Is there a genuine reason for people to buy this? The authors provide the buyer utility map to answer that seriously. Down one side, 6 stages of the buyer experience cycle: purchase, delivery, use, supplements, maintenance, and disposal. Across the top, 6 utility levers: customer productivity, simplicity, convenience, risk reduction, fun and image, and environmental friendliness. That gives you 36 spaces. Most companies compete in 2 or 3 of them and never look at the rest. The failure case cited is Philips CD Interactive, a technically clever product that demanded too much of buyers at almost every stage. Price comes second, and it comes before cost, which is the part most managers get backwards. You set a strategic price aimed at the mass of buyers from day one, rather than skimming and cutting later. To find it, the authors build the price corridor of the mass, list products that take a different form but do the same job, and products that take a different form and do a different job but serve the same objective. where the volume clusters, that is your corridor. Then choose a level inside the corridor based on how easily you can be copied. Weak legal or resource protection means price lower and price to capture the market before imitators arrive. Cost comes third, and it is target costing, not cost plus. Take the strategic price, subtract the profit margin you require, and what remains is the cost you must hit. If you cannot hit it, you have three levers, and none of them is quality reduction. Streamline operations and introduce cost innovations. Partner rather than build. And change the pricing model itself, for example leasing, subscription or slicing ownership, when the cost problem is really an affordability problem. Adoption comes fourth. Every blue ocean move threatens somebody, and the threatened parties are usually employees who fear for their roles, partners who fear for their channel, and sometimes the wider public. The answer offered is not persuasion after the fact, but open discussion before it, explaining why the move is necessary and what will happen to the people affected. Only when all four gates pass do you have what the authors call a commercially viable blue ocean idea. Part 3 turns to execution, and Chapter 7 asks how you get an organization to make a leap like this without a bottomless budget or 3 years of change management. The authors identify four hurdles. The cognitive hurdle, waking people up to the need to change when nothing appears to be on fire. The resource hurdle, doing it without more money. The motivational hurdle, moving the mass of people rather than the willing few. And the political hurdle, surviving the opposition of those with something to lose. Their answer is tipping point leadership. The core belief is that in any organization, disproportionate change follows from acting on a small number of people, acts and activities that carry disproportionate influence. You do not move the mass, you move the hinge points. The case is Bill Bratton's turnaround of the New York City Police Department in the mid-1990s. For the cognitive hurdle, he made senior officers experience the problem directly rather than read about it, requiring them to ride the subway rather than travel by car, so that the gap between the crime statistics and daily reality became personal. For the resource hurdle, he redistributed resources from cold spots to hot spots, concentrating effort where the crime and the public impact actually were, rather than spreading thinly and evenly. For the motivational hurdle, he used what the book calls fishbowl management, making performance and commitments visible across peers in regular open meetings, so that responsibility could not quietly evaporate. And for the political hurdle, he identified the natural supporters and the natural blockers in advance and secured a senior insider who knew where the resistance would come from before it arrived. Felony crime, murders and thefts all fell sharply over 2 years without a budget increase. The methodological lesson is the transferable part. Look for concentration, not coverage. Chapter 8 is the quietest chapter, and in practice, the one that decides whether any of this survives contact with real people. The problem is that a blue ocean strategy asks employees to do things differently in ways that cannot be fully specified in advance or fully monitored. That kind of work depends on voluntary cooperation, and voluntary cooperation cannot be instructed. What produces it, the authors argue, is fair process, and fair process has three components they label the three E principles. Engagement. Involve people in the decisions that affect them, ask for their input, and let them challenge the reasoning. This improves the decision, and more importantly, it changes how the decision is received. Explanation. Everyone affected should understand why the final decision was made as it was. People will accept an outcome they disagree with, and even one that costs them, if the reasoning is genuinely explained. What they will not accept is a decision that appears arbitrary. Expectation clarity. After the decision, state plainly what the new rules are, what people will be measured against, and what the consequences are. Ambiguity here reads as a trap, and people respond by protecting themselves. The point underneath all three is that people need intellectual and emotional recognition. Fair process builds trust and commitment. Trust and commitment produce voluntary cooperation. Voluntary cooperation is what makes execution possible. Its absence produces the familiar pattern of a strategy that everyone agrees with in the room and nobody enacts outside it. Chapter 9 is the first of the three chapters added in the 2015 expanded edition, and it addresses a failure mode the original book was criticized for underplaying. A strategy is not just the customer offer. the authors describe three strategy propositions that a business has to get right at once. The value proposition, which is what attracts buyers. The profit proposition, which is how the business makes money from that offer, covering both revenue model and cost structure. And the people proposition, which is what motivates the employees and partners who have to deliver it. For a blue ocean move to hold, all three must support the same thing, differentiation and low cost together. A brilliant value proposition with a profit proposition that cannot fund it is a well-loved failure. A strong value and profit combination that requires behavior your people are neither able nor motivated to deliver will decay quietly. Misalignment does not usually announce itself. It shows up as an initiative that works in the pilot and dies at scale. The example the chapter uses is Comic Relief in the United Kingdom, which value innovated fundraising itself. Instead of year-round solicitation, guilt-based appeals, and a focus on large donors, it created a single national event, Red Nose Day, built on humor and mass participation with very small donation amounts. The value proposition is that giving is fun and easy. The profit proposition works because the concentrated event structure and volunteer participation strip out the cost of fundraising. The people proposition works because volunteers, celebrities, and broadcasters all get something they want from taking part. All three point the same way, which is why it has raised extraordinary sums over decades with a small permanent organization. Chapter 10 deals with the obvious objection. Blue oceans do not stay blue. Imitators arrive, the water reddens. So what then? The author's first answer is that imitation takes longer than people assume, because a real value innovation carries natural barriers. It can conflict with an imitator's existing brand or business model. It can require an alignment of activities that is hard to copy piecemeal. It may enjoy network effects, cost advantages from volume, or in some cases legal protection. And it often requires competitors to accept a cognitive shift they are not willing to make while their current business is still profitable. The second answer is a discipline for knowing when to move. Keep drawing the strategy canvas. When your value curve begins to converge with the rest of the industry, that convergence is your signal, and it will show up in the picture long before it shows up in the margins. Until then, do not value innovate for its own sake. Keep improving value inside the blue ocean you created, and take the volume. The chapter draws a distinction worth holding on to. Value improvement is doing what you already do better, and it is a red ocean activity, which is not an insult, it is often the correct activity. Value innovation is a reconstruction of the offering itself. Confusing the two in either direction is expensive. At corporate level, renewal is managed through the pioneer, migrator, settler map. The job of leadership is to keep a live pipeline of pioneers moving, so that renewal is a process rather than an emergency. Chapter 11 is the author's response to a decade of watching people apply the framework badly. It lists 10 mental models that look like blue ocean thinking and reliably produce red ocean results. They are worth stating plainly because most readers will recognize at least two of their own. 1. That this is customer-oriented strategy. It is at least as much non-customer-oriented, and asking your existing customers what they want will keep you exactly where you are. 2. That you must venture beyond your core business. Many blue oceans were created inside the company's existing business. 3. That it requires new technology. Value innovation is about value, and plenty of blue oceans use no new technology at all. 4. That you must be first to market. Creating a blue ocean is not the same as pioneering a technology. The question is who first makes it commercially compelling. 5. That it is just differentiation. Differentiation in a red ocean means a premium offer at a premium cost. Blue ocean strategy means differentiation and low cost together. 6. That it is just a low-cost strategy. Same error, other side. Low cost alone is a red ocean position that ends in a price war. 7. That it is the same as innovation. Innovation that lacks buyer utility, an accessible price, and a viable cost structure is not a strategy. 8. That it is a marketing or niche play. Niche strategy means slicing existing demand more finely. Blue ocean strategy means aggregating demand across segments. 9. That competition is bad, or that this is somehow anti-competitive. The aim is not to beat competitors and not to condemn them. it is to make the comparison irrelevant. 10. That it is the same as disruption or creative destruction. Disruption displaces an existing market. A great many blue oceans are non-disruptive, creating new demand alongside existing markets rather than destroying them. This is the distinction the authors developed further in their later work. An honest summary should stop at the author's own case. So here is the reasonable criticism. The strongest objection is selection. The book identifies successful moves and reconstructs the logic behind them. That is a retrospective method, and it does not tell you how many companies applied similar thinking and failed, which means the framework's predictive power is unproven even where its explanatory power is compelling. The second objection is durability. Several of the book's own showcase cases were substantially imitated or overtaken within a decade, which suggests the barriers to imitation are thinner than the argument implies. The third is that the distinction between a blue ocean and a well-executed differentiation strategy is far easier to draw after the fact than before it. In the moment, most teams cannot tell which one they are attempting. And the fourth is that the book is much stronger on diagnosis than on delivery. The canvas, the grid, the six paths, and the utility map are excellent thinking tools. The execution chapters are shorter, more anecdotal, and lean heavily on a small number of cases. None of this makes the book less useful. It makes it a set of instruments rather than a guarantee, which is the right way to use it. If you want to actually apply this rather than admire it, the book compresses into a sequence you can run in a workshop. Draw the strategy canvas for your industry as it is today, honestly, including yourself. Look at how closely the curves track each other. Fill in the eliminate, reduce, raise, and create grid, and force real answers into the eliminate and reduce boxes, not just the raise and create ones. Walk all six paths deliberately, one at a time, rather than brainstorming freely. Alternative industries, strategic groups, the buyer chain, complementary offerings, functional and emotional appeal, and trends over time. Map the three tiers of non-customers and find the largest catchment. Then run the sequence as a set of gates, utility, price, cost, adoption, in that order, and be willing to fail your own idea at any one of them. Write the tagline. If it does not compress into one sentence that is both true and attractive to a buyer, keep working. And when you get to execution, remember the two things people skip. Concentrate resources on the hotspots rather than spreading them evenly, and run a fair process. Engagement, explanation, and expectation clarity, so that the people who must deliver the strategy actually own it. The lasting value of Blue Ocean strategy is not the metaphor, which has been repeated to the point of cliche. It is the insistence that market boundaries are not facts about the world. They are assumptions held collectively by everyone competing inside them, which means they can be redrawn by anyone willing to examine them. That was the summary of Blue Ocean Strategy by W. Chan Kim and Renee Mauborn. This narration is an original summary and commentary. It is not a substitute for the book, and if the frameworks were useful to you, the full text is worth owning. From the AIIO Book Library, thank you for listening.